I'd like to start off just introducing the other members of the legal team. Marlene Kamish, an attorney from Chicago, is the first attorney who was retained by Mumia after he discharged his prior attorneys. We've also retained a British barrister from London, Nick Brown, and a local Philadelphia attorney, J. Michael Farrell. So these are the attorneys who are now representing Mumia. At the press conference, the press conference was conducted outside of the federal courthouse in downtown Philadelphia, and we had just filed new evidence in the courthouse for the judge to review and also file the necessary legal papers to officially come onto the case as Mumia's new attorneys. And there's a number of different things that came up, the first of which, and I think perhaps the most important of which, is that Mumia himself has now submitted his own statement, a sworn statement that is filed in court, which is his testimony as to what happened that night. And I'd like to take an opportunity to read Mumia's statement as to what happened.
Please.
If we could do that now.
Yeah, please.
All right. This, as I said, this is sworn testimony under oath, which Mumia signed at the prison on May the 3rd, on Thursday, and which we filed in federal court on May the 4th, on Friday. And this is what Mumia's statement says. I, Mumia Abu-Jamal, declare, I am the petitioner in this action. If called as a witness, I could and would testify to the following from my own personal knowledge. I did not shoot police officer Daniel Faulkner. I had nothing to do with the killing of Officer Faulkner. I am innocent. At my trial, I was denied the right to defend myself. I had no confidence in my court-appointed attorney, who never even asked me what happened the night I was shot and the police officer was killed, and I was excluded from at least half the trial. Since I was denied all my rights at my trial, I did not testify. I would not be used to make it look like I had a fair trial. I did not testify in the post-conviction proceedings in 1995 on the advice of my attorney, Leonard Wineglass, who specifically told me not to testify. Now, for the first time, I have been given an opportunity to tell what happened to me in the early morning hours of December 9, 1981. This is what happened. As a cabbie, I often chose 13th and Locust Street because it was a popular club area with a lot of foot traffic. I worked out of United Cab on the night of 12/9/81. I believe I had recently returned from dropping off a fare in West Philly. I was filling out my log when I heard some shouting. I glanced in my rearview mirror and saw a flashing dome light of a police cruiser. This wasn't unusual. I continued to fill out my log trip sheet when I heard what sounded like gunshots. I looked again into my rearview mirror and saw people running up and down Locust. As I scanned, I recognized my brother standing in the street, staggering and dizzy. I immediately exited the cab and ran to his screen. As I came across the street, I saw a uniformed cop turn toward me, gun in hand, saw a flash, and went down to my knees. I closed my eyes and sat still, trying to breathe. The next thing that I remember, I felt myself being kicked, hit, and being brought out of a stupor. When I opened my eyes, I saw cops all around me. They were hollering and cursing, grabbing and pulling on me. I felt faint, finding it hard to talk. As I looked through this cop crowd all around me, I saw my brother, blood running down his neck, and a cop lying on his back on the pavement. I was pulled to my feet and then rammed into a telephone pole, beaten where I fell, and thrown into a paddy wagon. I think I slept until I heard the door open, and a white cop in a white shirt over the radio about his prisoner. I was informed by the anonymous crackle on the radio that I was en route to the police administration building a few blocks away. Then it sounded like ID'd as M1 came on the radio band telling the driver to go to Jefferson Hospital. Upon arrival, I was thrown from the wagon to the ground and beaten. I was beaten again at the doors of Jefferson. Because of the blood in my lungs, it was difficult to speak and impossible to holler. I never confessed to anything because I had nothing to confess to. I never said I shot the policeman. I did not shoot the policeman. I never said I hoped he died. I would never say something like that. I declare, under penalty of perjury, under the laws of the United States, that the above is true and correct and was executed by me on 3 May 2001 at Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. Signed, Mumia Abu Jamal.
Now, this is the first time Mumia has come forward. Why is it now? Why has he waited so long? I mean, you mentioned earlier that he was told not to testify in 1995, or he mentioned in his statement. Why is it that he has waited this long, though, otherwise?
Well, I think that the important thing is that Mumia has now provided sworn testimony in court as to what happened. He explains in his declaration that the attorney who was previously representing him and who continued to represent him until he was discharged and replaced told him specifically and advised him specifically not to testify. So I think it's clear the reason he hasn't testified was, as he explains in his declaration.
Okay. Now, in addition to the statement and affidavit by Mumia, there was also one filed by his brother, William Cook, who also has finally come forward for the first time with sworn statements. What is the gist of his statement?
Yes, what William Cook basically says, and what I could do is read a part of his declaration, is that he explains that he was, you know, in his car, in his Volkswagen, and he had a passenger in his Volkswagen, and he was stopped by the police car. He explains in his declaration that he did not attack or hit the police officer, but that the police officer, they had had a disagreement, basically, because William Cook was upset that he'd been stopped because he wasn't doing anything wrong, and the police officer hit him several times with some object, and then he went back to his car to get his registration, basically his papers. I assume his registration, his driver's license, etc. And as he was looking in his car to try to find these things, all of a sudden, shooting started. And I'll read you this part of it. When I first saw this is after the shooting started. When I first saw my brother, he was running. He was feet away from me. We hadn't made any plans to meet that night or anything like that. And I didn't even realize that he came around that area there to pick up fares. He had nothing in his hands. I heard a shot, and I saw him stumble. I didn't see who shot him. He was stumbling forward. And then William Cook explains that he looked back to see what was going on in his car, and then his passenger had disappeared. And he doesn't know exactly when the passenger left, but the door was open, and the passenger was gone. Now, afterwards, after this whole incident was over and after Billy Cook had been released by the police, the person who was his passenger told William Cook that there had been a plot to kill police officer Faulkner, and I'll quote this part from the affidavit. He told me that he was armed on that night and participated in the shooting. This is the passenger who was in William Cook's car at the time.
That's Ken Freeman, is that correct?
That's what's said in the affidavit.
Now, that's also the ID, wasn't that the ID that was found on Officer
Faulkner? No, there's an ID from another gentleman.
That's from another.
That was found. It's unclear from the evidence. There's some contradictions in the evidence whether this was allegedly found on the officer or whether this was found in the car.
Okay.
But there was an ID from another person, and that's never really been satisfactorily explained what the ID was doing there. But in any case, William Cook goes forward in his affidavit, and he explains that he was taken to the police station. He says, when they had me in the police station, they threatened to kill me and throw me in the river. I have been afraid for my life since that night. And he continues onward and says that he's referring to the attorney who represented Mumia at his original trial. I remember Jackson coming to my house several times. My mother and sister were there. I don't remember him ever interviewing me. I just remember him trying to calm us. And he says that if Jackson had wanted him to testify, he would have done it, but he was never asked to testify. See, this is what he says. If they, parentheses Jackson, had said they wanted me to testify, I would have done it, but they never did. And then he explains that he was expecting to testify at the PCRA, which was the post-conviction proceedings, which happened in 1995. And he says that one of the attorneys wanted him to testify, but Leonard, referring to Leonard Wineglass, didn't, so I didn't testify. But then he states that he will testify now. And then the declaration from William Cook concludes with the following. Mumia was not holding a gun. Mumia never intervened in anything between me and the cop. I had nothing to do with the shooting or killing of the police officer. My brother, Mumia Abu Jamal, had nothing to do with shooting or killing the policeman. And that is the declaration of William Cook, which was signed on April the 29th of this year. And that was filed in federal court on Friday also. Now, there's a number of significant points here, of course, one of which, and having now obtained this evidence, a number of assumptions that a lot of people have been making about the case are clearly not true, and the case needs to be viewed from a different perspective, a completely new perspective, than previously. And, you know, we'll get into that particularly when we get to the declaration of Arnold Beverly, who is the man who's come forward and stated that he is the person who actually shot Officer Faulkner and not Mumia Abu Jamal. But one of the points that's come forward is that Mumia actually did not see what happened between the police officer and his brother. People assume that Mumia saw the police officer beating his brother and went forward to intervene in that situation. But actually, Mumia didn't even see that. All that Mumia was aware of was he heard gunshots and he saw his brother staggering around, and then he went, you know, to the scene to see what was going on and what he could do. But he actually didn't even know that the police officer had beaten his brother. And then the other significant, and of course, the other significant fact is that although Mumia, since, you know, he was a cab driver, and cab driving is a very dangerous occupation, and he'd been robbed before at gunpoint, Mumia did have a gun, but he never drew his gun. He never had his gun out.
Right.
And his brother's testimony confirms that. His brother says that Mumia had nothing in his hands, i.e., he didn't have a gun in his hands or anything else in his hands. He just came upon the scene, and the next thing that happened was that Mumia himself got shot, and he was down.
Yeah, it sounds like, according to William Cook's testimony, that the officer had already been shot before Mumia even exited the cab. At least that's what I gather from reading this testimony.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, you know, you have to actually go to the scene where this thing happened, or, you know, to be able to understand it. It's a cross street. There's 13th Street and Locust Street, are cross streets, and where the incident occurred was on Locust Street, just, I think, I'm trying to remember my directions. Okay. 13th Street runs north and south, and Locust Street runs east and west, and the incident occurred on Locust Street, on the south side of Locust Street, east of 13th Street.
Right.
Mumia was going north on 13th Street, had crossed Locust Street, and had pulled over about 52 feet street, on the left-hand side of the street, it's a one-way street, and was double parked in front of a nightclub, an after-hours club, waiting for potential passengers to come out of the club. This happened at 4 in the morning when the after-hours clubs close and, you know, numerous people come out. So when this happened, he got out of the cab and then he ran basically diagonally from where he was to the location on Locust Street. So, you know, it took some time period for him to get from one point to the other. In any case, I think what you pointed out is basically the situation. The officer was shot before Mumia arrived on the scene. And that's also what Arnold Beverly says in his declaration, which we'll get to in a moment here. But as I was saying, the testimony from William Cook also confirms that there was no gun in Mumia's hands, that there was nothing in his hands. And in fact, when I said that we need to look at the evidence from a new perspective, now that we have the new evidence, if we go back and look at the evidence, even the prosecution's evidence, their alleged evidence at the original trial, it all fits into place now in a way that shows that, in fact, Mumia is innocent and didn't do it, because it's very significant that none of the prosecution witnesses testified that they actually saw a gun in Mumia's hands at the time the shooting took place. None of them did, and there's a good reason for that, which is that Mumia didn't have a gun in his hands, and Mumia didn't shoot the police officer.
Right. Even had they testified, I mean, I know a few of the witnesses have recanted their testimony in 1995 at the PCRA hearing, and one woman, her name slips me, I believe it was Jackson?
Jones, Veronica Jones.
Veronica Jones. Was arrested off the stand at that hearing after she recanted her initial testimony.
Yes, and she tried to point out that the police officers told her at the time that she was originally interrogated that if she went along with them, basically they would let her continue to work as a prostitute and not arrest her or harass her, and in her case, also not prosecute her on these weapons charges they had, which could have landed her in prison for a number of years. But they also told her they would give her the same deal that they had given to Cynthia White, who was one of the main witnesses against me at the trial, who was also a prostitute, who had numerous arrests, and you know, they obviously have the capacity to on the one hand entice and on the other hand threaten her to do what they wanted or else. So at this point it might be appropriate to move to the declaration of Arnold Beverly.
Right. Now, Arnold Beverly has come forward now and is alleging that he is actually the killer of Officer Faulkner. Can we talk about that?
Well, what Arnold Beverly has stated in his declaration is, first of all, Arnold Beverly has signed a declaration under penalty of perjury, which is basically the equivalent of a sworn statement. And we have taken this document, we have filed this in federal court, so we now have actual testimony by Arnold Beverly, just as if he was in court himself. We have written testimony that was filed in court on Friday. And Arnold Beverly has stated that he will come forward. He stated to us that he will come forward and he will testify in court and to what he states in his declaration. So I think perhaps the best thing to do is to actually let Arnold Beverly speak in his own words and read Arnold Beverly's declaration.
Okay.
So this is what Arnold Beverly says. I, Arnold R. Beverly, state that the following facts are true and correct. I was present when police officer Daniel Faulkner was shot and killed in the early morning hours of December 9, 1981, near the corner of Locust and 13th Streets. I have personal knowledge that Mumia Abu-Jamal did not shoot police officer Faulkner. I was hired, along with another guy, and paid to shoot and kill Faulkner. I had heard that Faulkner was a problem for the mob and corrupt policemen because he interfered with the graft and payoffs made to allow illegal activity, including prostitution, gambling, drugs, without prosecution in the Center City area. Faulkner was shot in the back shooting, I was shown a picture of Faulkner and told that Faulkner was supposed to check something at Johnny D's at 13th and Locust sometime in the early morning hours of December 9. Two of us were hired for the shooting so that either of us could take the opportunity to make the hit, get the job done, and leave. The other guy gave me a 38 caliber policeman special, and I was also carrying my own 22 caliber revolver. I waited at the speed line entrance. By the way, the speed line is the subway in Philadelphia. I waited at the speed line entrance at the northeast of corner of Locust and 13th at the parking lot. I was wearing a green camouflage army jacket. The other guy waited on the south side of Locust Street, east of 13th Street, towards Camac Street. While I was waiting at the speed line entrance for Faulkner to arrive at the location, I saw police officers in the area. Two undercover policemen were standing on the west side of 13th Street, north of Locust. Also, a uniformed police officer was sitting in a car in the corner of the parking lot. They were there while the shooting of Faulkner took place. I was not worried about the police being there, since I believe that since I was hired by the mob to shoot and kill Faulkner, any police officers on the scene would be there to help me. After a while, I saw Faulkner get out of a small police car parked behind a VW parked on Locust Street, east of 13th Street. Faulkner was alone. He got out of the police car and went up to the VW. I heard a shot ring out coming from east on Locust Street. Faulkner fell on his knee on the sidewalk next to the VW. I heard another shot, and it must have grazed my left shoulder. I felt something hard on my left shoulder. I grabbed at my shoulder and got blood on my hands. I ran across Locust Street and stood over Faulkner, who had fallen backwards on the sidewalk. I shot Faulkner in the face at close range. Jamal was shot shortly after that by a uniformed police officer who arrived on the scene. Cop cars came from all directions. Foot patrol also arrived. I saw a white shirt getting out of a car in the middle of the 13th and Locust intersection, just as I was going down to the speed line steps. I left the area underground through the speed line system and by prearrangement met a police officer who assisted me when I exited the speed line underground about three blocks away. A car was waiting for me and I left the Center City area. The foregoing is stated subject to the penalties of 18 Pennsylvania Criminal Statutes, Section 4904, relating to unsworn falsification to authorities. Signed, Arnold R. Beverly, 6899. So this is basically the equivalent of a sworn declaration that was signed by Arnold Beverly back in June of 1999.
Why is it that this has just now come forward?
Because when we took over the case as the new attorneys, reviewing the files of the previous attorneys, which, by the way, we're still doing, because we have like 50 boxes of files that we're still going through. But in the course of beginning to go through the files, we found this document. And when we found this document, we took some steps to verify it. And one of the attorneys actually was able to contact Mr. Beverly and interview him on a number of occasions, and we made a determination that, in our opinion, based upon the interviews of Mr. Beverly, reviewing his declaration, and looking at the other evidence and information we have at our disposal, it appears to us that this is credible testimony. And so, having made that determination, we decided that it was our responsibility to immediately file this with the court, mm-hmm. and that's what we did. Now, there's some interesting, obviously, there's a number of interesting points here. One of which is that it goes back to the point that you brought up earlier, that according to this declaration, as well as William Cook's declaration, Mumia was shot after Faulkner was shot. And indeed, according to Arnold Beverly's declaration, Faulkner didn't even shoot Mumia. Another police officer who arrived on the scene afterwards shot Mumia. Now, the reason I'm bringing attention to this particular point is that At the original trial, Mumia's attorney tried to bring up evidence that someone other than Faulkner had shot Mumia, and Judge Sabo refused to let that evidence in. And what that evidence was is kind of interesting. There was an early police report shortly after the incident took place which stated that Jamal was shot by officers arriving on the scene afterwards. And the prosecution did not hand that over to Mumia's attorney, although they're required by law to do so. But Mumia's attorney was given that by a confidential source that he had in the police department. So this evidence corroborates Beverly's evidence, and in fact, that's what happened. And of course, if Officer Faulkner did not shoot Mumia, then that shows that, you know, there was a lot more going on than had been put forth in the prosecution scenario. Now, in terms of other evidence, if we go back, that corroborates the evidence by Arl Beverly and also kind of takes all the previous evidence and reassembles it in a different pattern.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of points that are very interesting here. Arnold Beverly states in his declaration that he was wearing a green army jacket. Now, that's very significant because there's numerous witnesses who testified at the previous trial and witnesses who were interrogated by the police but weren't called to testify who all said that the person who shot Faulkner was wearing a green army jacket. And Mumia was not wearing a green army jacket. They recovered, and part of the evidence is the jacket he was wearing that night, which is a white and red and I think black quilted jacket, which is clearly not a green army jacket. So the fact that it was Beverly who was wearing the green army jacket is very significant. Also in William Cook's declaration, he also states that the passenger in his car was wearing a green army jacket that night, because the passenger had previously been in the army and he always wore his green army jacket around. Now, the other thing is, when I was in Philadelphia, I went with Attorney Marlon Kamish to the scene where this incident took place at 13th and Locust. And it's very interesting to look at that scene. You know, the neighborhood's changed a lot in the last 20 years. I mean, in that time period, this was a neighborhood of after-hour clubs. It was a pretty seedy neighborhood. It was a neighborhood where there was a lot of prostitution, a lot of drug sales. It was a pretty heavy-duty neighborhood. But it was also kind of like a popular spot for people to go, you know, for after-hour clubs. Now it's gotten very yuppified.
Mm-hmm, it sure has.
It's still basically intact. And the thing is, it's an older part of the city. You know, Philadelphia is one of the first American cities. It's an older part of the city where the streets are very small and very narrow. And it's a very small area. And when we went there, I mean, it looks almost like a movie set or kind of like, you know, Disneyland or something in the sense that this is not a wide, modern street. This is a very small area. And what I'm getting to is when you look at the scene, this is a perfect ambush site. If you were going to plan to kill somebody and shoot them down, this is a perfect place to do it because the area is so small. What it means is that you could have a couple of people lying in wait for the victim, and they could carry out the shooting using handguns, which have a short range, and effectively get the job done. Plus, there's a number of places where the people waiting for the victim to show up can hide, and then emerge from their hiding places, carry out the killing, and then escape very easily. For example, Arnold Beverly said that he was standing at the speed line steps. You know, on three corners of that intersection, there are entrances to the subway system. And what that means is you can stand there down on the steps that are going down under the street, and there's like big metal, there's kind of like handrails with big metal, big pieces of metal.
It's almost like a fence.
Right there, so that you could kind of like stand down on the steps behind the metal, be protected. Nobody could really see you, but you could see the area. And when the victim emerged, you know, when the victim appeared, you could come up the steps, just like Arnold Beverly said he did, shoot the victim, and then you got three different sets of subway stairs that you can then go right back down again, and you're underground, and you can go like three blocks, you can go down about three blocks to the next major street, and and there's no one out there on the street who can see you. And generally, the thing about the Philadelphia subway system is there aren't that many people on it, especially at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
I don't know if the subway's even running. But you can just dive down under the street, and then there's, like, no witnesses out on the street to see you, and you can just go, you know, either direction up to the next exit, emerge, jump into a car, and you're off.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was basically Beverly's story. Now, with regard to the other shooter, or, you know, the accomplice, that, you know, Beverly says he had an accomplice. Presumably, the other shots that he refers to that were fired by his accomplice. The accomplice was down on Locust Street on the other side of where, you know, Faulkner came out of his squad car, on the south side of the street, down towards Kamak or Kamak Street. Kamak Street is actually a little alleyway type street,
real
a very
small.
Narrow one that's going down towards the next major street of 12th Street. And before you get to Kamak Street, there's another kind of very narrow alley between Kamak and 13th Street where the shooting took place. So the accomplice could very easily have hidden right around the corner of a building there at Kamak Street, and then when Faulkner emerged, came up closer and hidden right around the corner of a building at this little narrow alleyway, and then come out when the time was right to begin shooting, and as soon as the shooting was over, just run back down Kamak Street, or run back to the alley, and just run down the alley and run away, and no one would see him. So, I mean, this was, if you were going to plan to ambush somebody, this is like a perfect ambush site, which also makes, you know, the account, I think, plausible that this is the way it happened, and also explains some of the earlier evidence. There's a number of witnesses who testified that they saw one or two people running away from the scene after Faulkner was shot.
Now, Arnold Beverly, in his statement, says he was shot in the shoulder. Officer Faulkner was shot once in the back and once in the face, but it sounds like there was a third shot somewhere there that hit Arnold Beverly. And also, I mean, he also stated that he had an accomplice who was waiting, I don't have it exactly in front of me, but waiting at another entrance. Where was it? The other guy waited on the south side of Laurel, of Locust.
Locust, yes.
East of 13th, towards Kamak.
Towards Kamak Street.
But then in William Cook's testimony, he doesn't quite say this, but it's, as I read it, it sounded as if he almost points the finger at Ken Freeman, or the person he refers to as Poppy, in his testimony.
Well, the thing is, he says he doesn't really see, he didn't really see what happened. All he knew is that the passenger in his car was gone, you know, at some point during the incident, but that the passenger later told him that he had been part of a plot to shoot Faulkner. Now, it's, you know, entirely possible, and in fact, you know, makes sense that if somebody, I mean, I guess what we need to do is take a step back and look at another major part of this. What Arnold Beverly is saying is that he was hired as a hitman with an accomplice by basically corrupt elements within the police department itself who were working hand in hand with organized crime with regard to running the prostitution and the numbers and the other criminal activities in Center City, Philadelphia, and that it was these people who hired him, and it was these people who wanted to get rid of Faulkner because Faulkner was getting in the way and presumably was not willing to go along with, you know, taking the bribes and, you know, doing the other things that were that the corrupt police were involved in. So it's entirely possible that, and quite plausible, that if somebody upstairs someplace planned this whole thing and hired people, that they might have hired some people, you know, that everybody involved in the plot didn't know who everybody else was. I mean, that makes very good sense. And there may have been, you know, some people, you know, someone was supposed to be in one place and they didn't know who their accomplices were going to be, but they knew that other people might be there or, you know, and they had a particular job to do. And then there were other people who were supposed to be in another place and there's, you know, carry out this other part of the job. So what it sounds like is that there were at least three people involved in pulling this thing off at the scene. And in terms of the physical evidence, this took place in front of 1234 Locust Street, and after the incident, there was a bullet recovered from the door at 1234 Locust Street, and there were bullet fragments from two other bullets recovered from the door. his jacket and then went out, went through his jacket, basically. Went in one side of his jacket and out another side, and apparently did not pass through Faulkner.
Didn't hit his body.
Right.
Okay.
So that gives us another shot, and the there's somewhat, well, you know, so you know, there's evidence there are a number of shots fired.
Well, Ken Freeman, it appears that was obviously, or it appears to be involved in this incident or crime, murder. Where is Ken Freeman now?
He's dead.
He's dead.
Ken Freeman, see, this is very, this is something that's very odd that was brought up earlier, which was the day after the Philadelphia police bombed the Move House in downtown Philadelphia. You may recall there were a number of confrontations between the Move organization and the Philadelphia police, and the Move people, there's a big dispute about this house they were living in. The police wanted to come in, supposedly, to inspect the house, and the Move people were refusing to let them in because they considered police went on for a couple of months, with the police having the house surrounded and not letting any, them have any electricity or water or food, etc. Finally, the police actually sent a police helicopter over the house, dropped a bomb on the house, blew up and destroyed the house,
and
killed a number
homes.
Of people, including children, and burned down, as a result, like two blocks of Philadelphia, burning down people's houses. The day after this happened, Kenneth Freeman was found naked with his hands handcuffed behind him with a hypodermic needle in his arm in a vacant lot, supposedly having overdosed. The autopsy report said that he died of a heart attack, which is rather suspicious circumstances.
Wow.
So.
And he was found May 14th, 1985, the day after the Move bombing.
After the Move bombing. So, wow. If in fact he was involved in the incident, it may well be that the people who planned the incident decided that this was a necessary time to keep his mouth shut.
And with the cover of all the news around the Move siege, it would easily have just probably slipped right through unnoticed.
Right, but yeah, the publicity around the Move thing just dominated, you know, all of the media, so I'm sure, you know, there was nothing else really came out at that time. So, here we have it, and what we see now is that basically what was happening here, oh, I guess before I get into, you know, kind of trying to comment on the situation, there's another piece of important evidence that I'd like to point to, which we also filed, which is that we filed an affidavit by Donald Hersing. Donald Hersing is a very important witness because Donald Hersing was had been a private detective, and he was a confidential source, in other words, an informer for the FBI, back in the same period that this incident occurred, where Mumia was shot and the police officer was killed. And during the time that Mumia's case was on trial, Donald Hersing was an informant for the FBI in an investigation. Actually, there were three independent FBI investigations taking place in this time period of corruption in the Philadelphia Police Department. And there was a major series of articles in the Philadelphia Inquirer about Donald Hersing and about the whole situation of corruption in the Philadelphia Police Department. As a result of these investigations, the assistant chief of police in Philadelphia was convicted of corruption-related charges and removed from the police department. The head of homicide was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in a federal indictment. Approximately 30 police officers, including the head of the central division. And this is very significant because this incident, because police officer Faulkner was working out of the 6th Precinct. And the 6th Precinct was part of the Central Division. The police, I think it was a captain or inspector is what they call him back there. The police inspector in charge of the Central Division was also convicted of corruption-related charges and removed from the police department. And a police inspector who came on the scene of the incident after Faulkner and Mumia were shot and who was the ranking officer in charge of the whole investigation at the crime scene, he resigned from the police department the day after Mumia's trial, and I believe was also named as a unindicted co-conspirator.
He resigned?
Yes. He was named convicted as well. He did not testify at Mumia's trial. The day after the trial was over, he resigned from the police department. Now,
what were his stated reasons for resigning?
I don't know that. However, in Donald Hersing's... Now, see, Donald Hersing was actually... He was operating what was called a modeling studio in Philadelphia. And a modeling studio was basically a brothel, or a, in common parlance, a whorehouse.
Mm-hmm.
And in his affidavit, and also in these newspaper articles that were published at the time in the Philadelphia Inquirer, he basically said that he was getting sick of the whole situation because of all the payoffs he had to make to the Philadelphia police to operate his business and the continuous police harassment. So he went to the FBI, and the FBI took him in as an informer and wired him for sound and had him continue his activities so they could bring a case against the corrupt police officers involved. And I'd just like to read briefly a couple of points from the affidavit of Donald Hersing, which we also filed in court last Friday. It says here, Inspector John Benedetto took over as commanding officer of the Central Division of the Philadelphia Police Department on about June 1, 1981. I first met D. Benedetto in August 1981. At that meeting, D. Benedetto personally told me that when he took over the Central Division in June, he had gathered his officers together and informed them, from that point on, all payoff money was to be passed up to him, D. Benedetto, whereupon he would return to each vice squad member a sum of money, about $50. During this conversation, D. Benedetto asked me if I had been making payments to any of his officers. When I informed him that I had been paying $500 a month to a vice officer, George Woods, D. Benedetto became outraged because Woods had not been delivering that money to him, D. Benedetto. And D. Benedetto said that he would take care of Woods because he, Woods, had been disloyal. A few days later, D. Benedetto told me he had demoted Woods to the status of a uniformed officer and had transferred him to another district. I continued making payments to D. Benedetto during the fall of 1981 and the spring of 1982 via his lieutenant, John Smith. Now, what basically went on is that the police would go to the people who operated the houses of prostitution and also go to the individual prostitutes and demand that they pay them protection money, basically, just like the mafia does. And that if they didn't pay them protection money, they would raid them and throw the prostitutes in jail and disrupt the business. So all the prostitutes and all the whorehouse owners in, you know, central Philadelphia were all paying protection money to the police. And what the police would do is they would send, you know, on a regular basis, a police officer would go to, you know, the whorehouse owner and or the prostitutes, and pay, and they'd be bagmen, just like mafia bagmen, and they'd pick up the payoff money, and then they would come back and they would deliver it to the higher-ups. And then everybody involved, you know, would get their little percentage of it, but the money would go, you know, up the chain of command to whoever was directing it. And this guy who became the head of the Central Division of the Philadelphia Police Department apparently had previously been in charge of the Internal Affairs Division, who was supposed to clean up the corruption in the police department. Then they sent him over to the Central Division, and then we've got the statement by Hersing in his affidavit that when he took over the Central Division, he basically centralized all the payoffs and made sure that all the payoff money in the Central Division was going to come into his hands.
Wow.
Now, the other thing, and this is very significant as well, is that you have these after-hours clubs in Philadelphia where they would, even though legally you were supposed to stop serving alcohol at 2 in the morning or 3 in the morning, they would continue to serve, of course, until like 4 in the morning. And that was why people would go to the after-hour clubs. And there were a number of after-hour clubs right at 13th and Locust where the incident took place. In fact, there was a famous club from that period called Club Whispers, which is where Mumia Jamal was waiting with his cab right outside that club for when the people came out to, you know, to get a passenger. What the police would do is they would go to all of these after-hour clubs, and they would tell them that they had to pay them off or they were going to raid them because they were serving alcohol after hours, which is against the law. So they would get payoff money from all the after-hour clubs. And, you know, like one company, and then they would split it up among all the officers on the different shifts that worked that area where that club was located, and the money would go up the chain of command to whoever the, you know, the highest ranking officer was who was in charge of these payoffs. Now, you've basically got this operation going on, just like the mafia operation. They come in and go, okay, you know, you need protection, we're going to sell you protection. This is, you know, this is the situation. And this is the this is what I want to point out. This is very significant. The police actually had an official police department form, which they would use to do what they called head counts in the after-hours clubs. In other words, on a regular basis, they would send uniformed police officers or, you know, detectives into the club, and they would count the number of customers in the club. And they would write this down on a police department form, and they would send this in to, you know, the supervising officer. And in fact, a couple of officers who appeared on the scene after Faulkner was killed had just been at one of these clubs filling out one of these forms. Now, there's no police reason in terms of enforcing the law why they needed to know how many people were in the clubs. Do you know why they did this? Would you like to know why they did
this? Yeah,
the reason they did this was so that they would know how much money each club owner was making, because they could estimate it from the number of customers. So they would know how much protection money to charge. So when the club owner said, no, I can't pay that much money, business is not that good, they would say, what are you talking about? We got it documented here. You had 160 people in your club on Friday, and you had 180 people in the club on Saturday, and we know you charge so much for cover, and of course everybody there is drinking, so there's no way you can tell us you can't afford to pay this amount of protection money. They actually used it as an accounting method to figure out how much the club owners could afford to pay them within their profit margin for protection money. That's how organized and how rampant and pervasive the corruption was within the Philadelphia Police Department. So there's a number of other points that suggest that Faulkner indeed was the victim of a hit, because he apparently refused to go along with this stuff, and presumably, instead of taking the protection money, he would actually go out and arrest the people who were selling drugs or the prostitutes, and there was a lot of ill feeling about this, and suspicion that Faulkner himself might have been an FBI informer, because Faulkner was transferred to the 6th Precinct from the 23rd Precinct, and it had come out that there were police officers in the 23rd Precinct who were acting as informers for the FBI. So the fact he came in from the 23rd Precinct may have made him suspicious to the people in his precinct in the first place. Also, Faulkner's wife was interviewed about a week after her husband was killed, and she said two things in her interview that are very significant. You know, she was saying there are two very unusual things that happened around the incident. One was that about 2 weeks before Officer Faulkner was killed, he had tried to get that night off. The night that he was killed, he had tried to get that night off about 2 weeks earlier because they wanted to go to a concert or something, and they'd refused to give him the night off. Hmm. The other thing that's very suspicious and significant is that Faulkner's normal routine was that he would drive down to the station in his civilian clothes, put on his uniform at the station, and put on his bulletproof vest at the station. But that night, for some reason, and this almost never happened, but that night, for some reason, he put on his uniform at home, directly out on patrol, and he did not put on his bulletproof vest. And had he had his vest on that night, he might have survived, because the first shot might have been stopped by the vest, and he might have been able to defend himself. So, you know, when his widow made those statements, you know, a week later, that was just, for her, something unusual and kind of an ironic twist of fate.
Right.
That if only, you know, things had been different, Faulkner would not have been killed. But now if we look at that from the perspective of the evidence we have now, that would be additional circumstantial evidence that, in fact, somebody in the police department was involved in setting him up to be killed that night.
Wow. This is a lot to take in.
So this
really
be sensory overload at this point.
A little. It's a little much. I wanted to get your comments on how you see the movement to win Mumia justice the protest movement that has emerged over the last decade, how this plays in part with winning Mumia's freedom.
Well,
in addition to all this new evidence that's coming forward.
Well, I think that what we have now, you know, Mumia has always said that he was innocent, and the basic orientation of the political movement has been to say that he was framed. Now we actually have the evidence to prove it,
right,
to prove what happened, to prove that he is innocent, to prove that he was framed. And I think what we need to do is we need to go forward strongly with this evidence and get the word out. And part of the reason that it's important to get the word out and to show a very strong and visible presence is that the prosecution has also lied all the way through this case, consciously lied that there was nobody at the scene when this occurred except for Faulkner himself and Mumia and Billy Cook. In fact, there were several after-hour clubs right at this intersection, and it was just at the time when people were leaving the clubs. There were probably hundreds of people in the area when this took place. And there's numerous witnesses who actually saw what happened, but who have been afraid to come forward up until this point. We're sure there are probably witnesses out there that we don't even know about. There are written witness statements from witnesses that no one's ever been able to locate.
Right.
If, now that this information is out, and now that Arnold Beverly has actually come forward and taken responsibility himself for what he's done, we're hoping that other people who saw what happened and weren't involved, but were still afraid to come forward because of, you know, the
obvious police corruption,
obvious, you know, problems there, will now be emboldened to come forward and testify also. And I think it's very important that that this get out and that the demand that Mumia be freed immediately go forward, because this man is not only awaiting execution, 20 years have been taken from his life.
Yeah.
He's been in prison for 20 years, and he's innocent, and he should be freed.
He should be freed.
He should be freed. That's our position, is that he should be freed. And if after all of this, the prosecution decides they're still going to go ahead and retry him on all this fabricated evidence, you know, that's their decision to make, and we'll fight that every inch of the way. But our position is the evidence is fabricated. The man didn't do it. He should be free.
Now,
there's an investigation to take place. There should be an investigation of the Philadelphia Police Department and the prosecution.
This case is basically in its final appeals process. Is that right? I mean, could you explain the legal situation where it stands now?
Yes. The way the legal situation is, you know, we should probably like recapitulate. There was a trial. There was a direct appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that was denied. There was then what is called in 1995 post-conviction hearings in front of Judge Sabo, who was the original trial judge, and Judge Sabo ruled against Mumia. There was then an appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and they ruled against Mumia. Now, we have filed a petition. Well, we haven't filed it. It was originally filed by the prior attorneys, but there is filed in the U.S. District Court in Philadelphia a petition for writ of habeas corpus, which is basically going to the federal court system and saying that Mumia's federal constitutional rights were violated in the state court proceedings, and that the federal courts should now look into this and throw out his conviction and throw out his death sentence. So this is now set before Judge Yon in the federal court for that purpose. And what we are waiting is for those proceedings to go forward. We're in the process of, you know, we've just come onto the case, so we're going through the files, we're conducting our own investigation. We expect to have other evidence to present when the evidence is found and sufficiently corroborated. And then there should be a hearing in the federal court on the evidence and on the habeas corpus petition. And if the judge, we believe what the judge should do once that takes place is based upon everything that we've got, even now, and certainly on what we expect to have in the future, the judge has the power to quash or throw out the conviction and death sentence and to order that Mumia be released.
Immediately.
Yes, he can order his immediate release. And then it's up to the state of Pennsylvania to decide what they're going to do.
So if the judge does order Mumia released, then the state can, again, refile charges. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, the state has the right, if they wish to do so, to proceed and file charges again and persist in their 20-year effort to frame an innocent man. And that's another reason why we believe that the movement around Mumia's case, you know, the political movement around his case, is important so that it'll be made very clear to the district attorney's office that not only people around the world and around the country, but that the people of the city of Philadelphia do not want this frame-up to continue. Because the district attorneys are supposed to be public servants. They're supposed to represent the public. And I think that once it's made very clear that the public are tired of an innocent man being prosecuted, that will be significant. Now, if for some reason the judge should rule against Mumia, and given, you know, the evidence, it's hard to imagine that something like that would happen, the next step would be to, the judge would have to certify, basically, that an appeal could be taken to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And if the judge didn't do that, then we would have to go to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals through another procedure and basically ask permission to file an appeal with them.
Wow. This is a lot to take in. We are running out of time here, and I want to thank you for taking almost an hour out of your day today, or more so than an hour out of your day, to join us and give us some updates on this case. I'm wondering if you could just close on any final thoughts you have, things that we may have not covered in this interview.
Well, the only thing that I'd like to mention is that there is going to be a major demonstration on May the 12th, Saturday, both in San Francisco and in Philadelphia. And anyone who's concerned with the case of Mumia, and anyone who wants to see justice done, and anyone who wants to see Mumia freed, should do whatever they can to attend the demonstration. Certainly people up in Santa Cruz are close enough to San Francisco to be there on May the 12th for Mumia, and people on the East Coast who can get to Philadelphia are able to get there for Mumia. So I think that, you know, the word has to be spread. The documents that we read today and other documents which were filed in federal court but we didn't get a chance to get to, if they're not already posted or going to be posted on the Internet, on the various websites having to do with Mumia's case, so people should read the documents, forward them on to other people they know, and get the word out about what's happening in the case.
All right. Well, Elliot Grossman, I want to thank you again for taking this time out of your day. And I hope all goes well in this case. I've been anxiously anticipating Mumia's release for some time now, as a number of people in this area have, and really appreciate the work that you're doing to bring attention to this and to get the facts out, the truth out about this case, which I don't think we have seen until recently. Some of this truth is finally coming out now. And I guess just to end this, I would just wish you the best of luck in the future proceedings regarding this case.
Thank you very much, Vince, and free Mumia.
All right.
Goodbye.
Bye.
And you're tuned to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. We've been speaking with Elliot Lee Grossman, Los Angeles attorney, now one of the legal representation, legal team for Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we're going to take a brief musical break.